I don't know about you, if you have heard of Samvega and Posada before the Dhamma talk last night, but I had never heard of it until last year. It's the first time we don't even talk about it. And we talk about it indirectly because we talk about disenchantment and dispassion. And we hear about that term, disenchantment, but if we don't talk about what disenchantment is pointing to, you can be left with thinking that disenchantment is about the English understanding of disenchantment. And I wanted to just share what that English understanding of disenchantment means. It says, free from illusion, or let's see, let's find the disenchant, the root word. No longer happy. No longer happy, pleased, or satisfied. This is what our English ear hears when we hear the word disenchantment. No longer happy, pleased, or satisfied. Disappointed, dissatisfied. These are some of the words that are connected to it. Disillusion. Disillusioned. Bluffed. Or deluded, duped, fooled. It's as if the joy of life is gutted if we get disenchanted. And we hear that and practice in a practice that the Buddha was pointing to disenchantment. He pointed to it over and over and over and over and over. And yet his pointing, what he was pointing to, we don't want to go because we hear it in our ordinary understanding of the word disenchantment. And we think that in somehow, in order to be enlightened, I got to give up everything. Everything that makes me happy, everything that pleases me, everything that exists that's worth, makes the whole thing worth living, I got to give it all up and live in a world that's full of disappointment and dissatisfaction. So I'm gonna hold off on getting that far. We kind of pull back a little bit, reserve a little bit, so we don't have to full on into the practice, because what we think we're full on into is, not very joyful. And that is so far removed from the truth of it that we get stuck staying in suffering while we're trying to practice a way out of suffering. It's because we need to begin to talk about Samvega and Posada and what these two emotional qualities do for us. Samvega is what happened to the Buddha when we know the story that he went out and he saw the dead person and the sick person and the old person. And when he saw it, and his chariot driver was saying, yeah, this is going to happen to all of us. it's kind of a little shocking because at that time, in Buddha's own accounts, when he, there are suttas where Buddha describes what his life was like before he had these encounters with these, what are called messengers. But he would say he was a young man, full of life, robust, that he had women at his beck and call. He was beautiful, long black hair. Everybody wanted him and he didn't want for nothing. This is the way he described his life. You know, I'm perfect. And then as a young man, he sees the inevitability of where he's going. I don't care how beautiful you are now. At some point, old age is going to catch up with you and you're going to have to see a whole new being. When he understands that, he can't quite understand why he turns away in disgust of something that's going to happen anyway. So here he is, he sees it, he turns away. He's like, I don't want to, I can't believe that. I'm not going to accept that. That's not going to be me. That's the way we are. We're like, oh yeah, when I'm in my 20s, I'm like, oh yeah, that's not going to be me. Uh-uh. You know, but I have a different understanding of that now that I'm in my 60s. It's like, yeah, okay. That's a whole nother world. But the Buddha, before he left, he had a moment when he saw something. And this something is what just is the fundamental ground of disenchantment. So when he saw the messengers, he kind of thought that was out there. That's what's going to happen to those people. Not going to happen to me. But then he gets up. I guess they had some kind of party or something. He gets up late at night, early morning hours, he said, before anyone else got up in the house. And he saw people lying around asleep. They had drank too much. They were all on top of each other. And he saw them and they looked ordinary, not sparkly, not shiny, all dressed up like they were when they came to the party. They looked ordinary. And somehow this sparkliness of the party lost its luster. And when it lost its luster, he couldn't put it all back together again. Addicts will tell you they go through this. There's a point when everything dismantles, everything falls apart. And they will tell you they can't put it back together. And when they can't put it back together, they pick it, it's lost its luster. The drugs, the alcohol, whatever it is. I remember when, you know, my whole life was spent pushing out my happiness till the semester after this one. You know, I was in law school, single parent, mostly on welfare. So I've always living, you know, with very little money, very little capacity. And I'm trying to get through law school because I have this belief if I get through law school, life's going to be much better. So I'm pushing it out and pushing it out and pushing it out. And I'm teaching my boys, push it out, push it out. Don't worry about now. Just get past this semester. Get past, get past, get past. I got out of law school, all happy, took the bar, and I failed it. And my initial thoughts was, I'm still stuck in the luster. We're just going to push it out. It's going to work. So there must be something racist about the bar. Certainly not me, because I'm like a lawyer. So I'm smart. I blew it right on off. And I remember the day it was after I found out, I took the bar again, pushing it out. Then comes the second bar announcement, and I failed that one. And I failed the bar the second time. Something shifted underneath me, some kind of ground shift, something shook. I'm thinking, this is not the way it's supposed to be. Something's wrong. all my pushing out. It's not working. And then one Sunday, I was getting ready to go to church, trying to fix my hair, trying to pretend like I'm not looking at myself in the mirror, but I'm so upset. I don't want to cry. I don't want to get upset. I just want to take the bar again and get past this stupid bar. And it all just came flooding in on me. This was not going to work. Something was wrong. This pushing it out until the future, it was going to get better. It just was not working. And everything fell apart in that moment. So after church, go to the bookstore. I'm looking for a book. I got to find me a book that's going to teach me how to have a happy life, even when everything was going wrong. Because I had resolved at that point, that's it. It's just going to be messed up. I'm not going to have the life I thought I was going to have. But I didn't want to be miserable. I wanted to be happy, even though my life was not going to be anything like I thought. That resolve to find something, what His Holiness said is that you feel into the suffering, and then something inside you says you look for a path that will find your way out of it. And that's what I did. I went to the bookstore, found this book by Trungpa Rinpoche. I don't know if you guys can see it, but it's that book sitting right there. I have it. I've had it for now 30 years. Just this little book about the 59 slogans of Lojong practice of Tibetan Buddhism. I didn't even know Tibetan Buddhism. I didn't know about Trungpa. I didn't know anything. I just found this book, opened it up. I looked through lots of books, but this one, I opened it up. And the first slogan I opened to said, abandon all hope. And this is a book on cultivating loving kindness, training the mind. I could not reconcile how abandoning hope would get you to a level of loving kindness. And I bought the book just for that reason. Like, okay, we're going to have to read this because something's amiss here. Because what I had before built everything up on no longer worked. So I'm open to the possibility of something different, something new. Not because I'm trying to fit something, some information into my old system, that's still enchantment. But because I am disenchanted with the old, I am poised to hear and see something new. And that's what Buddha was poised for, and willing to leave his entire family in order to go find it. And in some respects, many of us that are practitioners, we either don't tell our family and friends about it, or it's vastly different than the world that we live in. So there's a something different that we turn towards. And for years, I grew up in a Christian house. Everything about my life was Christian. So for years, I would not say that I was Buddhist. I would say I am, what did I call myself? A Christian Buddhist. So Christian first, Buddhist second. So that my family would understand why I was doing meditation and everything. And they would tolerate it if I was a Christian Buddhist. And then time went on a little bit, and next thing I know, I was a Buddhist Christian. I'm a Buddhist Christian, Buddhist first. And then finally, it was about 10, maybe 12 years ago, I said, yeah, I'm just Buddhist. I'm not really a Christian anymore. It's just Buddhist. And I had all prepared, and I was going to do it at this family dinner we were all having, and everybody's sitting there, and I'm like, okay, you guys, I have to tell you something. I'm not Christian. I'm a Buddhist. And they're all looking at me eating. They're like, my sister, the main sister that used to pick at me and say I was going to hell all the time, she just looks at me and says, Tori, we all knew you were Buddhist the first time you came in and said you were a Christian Buddhist. There's no such thing as a Christian Buddhist. So we knew you were a Buddhist then. It just took you all that time to figure it out. It's sort of like this is what happens. With some Vega and Posada, we know we're not going back, but we're not quite sure where we're going. So we pick this path and we get on the path. And we put our faith in the path, itself. Just like loving kindness points us towards non-harm, how to be in the world in a non-harm way, not harming ourselves, not harming others. Samvega and Posada is all about trust, building trust into our own inner capacity, rather than putting our trust outside of us into other things that we think is where our security and safety lies. So the capacity that we're actually touching into, just like with metta, we're building this capacity of kindness. With Samvega and Posada, we're building this capacity to trust in our ability to awaken. Not to pretend like we can awaken, but to begin to trust this mind can awaken. It can be free of suffering, mostly because we've seen it already. It's not something that's foreign to us. It's why I asked you to consider, what's it like when your sits are, you're just letting it happen. Sounds going by, construction sounds, it doesn't matter. Somebody's talking, I'm sitting there, we're at ease with it, it's fine. But when we get entangled in a discussion about whether that construction sound should be there, then we start feeling a lot of tension, difficulty. What Samvega, the way it's translated is, this is why I couldn't say it last night, is futility of our existence. The futility of our existence. That's what I felt. The pointlessness of all the effort I had put into trying to get through the bar, trying to get through law school. It's an idea that we don't have any more control and that we're going to lose whatever we have that we love. We're not going to get what we want in the first place. And we're going to get a lot of stuff that we don't want. It creates within us a deep sense of urgency. This is why Samvega is an awakening quality, because it's like when I realized everything I had thought of was no more. I was bamboozled. I was tricked. This was not going to be all gravy once I got through law school. What it created in me was a sense of urgency to go find a way to seek out this happiness that was more rooted in reality. So this Samvega, as much as it touches into complete disenchantment and dispassion, it also points towards urgency to find a way. And that's why it's coupled with Posada, because Posada is what happened to the Buddha when he left home. And he left home and he's going to look for this path. And first he came up on these, you know, deep jhana practitioners. And he could do that jhana with no problem. And so they wanted him to stay there and teach, but he wouldn't. And the reason why he wouldn't stay there is because to stay there, he would never find liberation. He would have to give up his search for finding a way to liberate the mind from suffering. And because no matter how high you get in jhanas, you're going to have to come back down at some point and just eat. You're going to come back to the suffering world. So he moved on and tried the aesthetic practices and then moved on there. And then ultimately what turned him towards liberation was a moment when he saw the peace of his childhood moment. So there's a moment in his story when he is sitting there near death and he has a memory of being a kid when there was all this kerfuffle going on and having a big festival with his father and everything's going great. And so this is an older man now dying. He's not old. He's still very young. I think he was maybe in his late 20s or early 30s. So he's still young, but I mean, he's seen a lot since he left home. And he's dying. And he remembers this thought when he was a kid, when he was very peaceful. He felt very much in the world, but not of the world. And in that thought, he thought to himself, might there be another way? Might there be another way? So he needed to get his strength together and then practice this other way. And when he got his strength together to practice this other way, as soon as he took something to eat, all of his friends pretty much left him because he had given up. That's what they thought. So this putting his trust in this path that he had done, he began to understand how to move. When he was with the jhanas teachers, he began to see how to move into this process, not because he somehow knew what to do, but more because he knew what his path was. And if he stayed there, he could not stay with his path. That's why he left. When he was with his friends and all the Jains practicing these aesthetic practices, he didn't know at that time he was going to awaken. He didn't know, but he thought, I'm still not getting to my goal here. I'm still suffering here. So might there be another way? But the telling part to me of that moment is that what Buddha Siddhartha at that time, what Siddhartha saw, this regular guy trying to find a way to liberate the mind, he saw pleasure not born of him. He saw this capacity to experience joy and liberation and freedom that was not born of him. And that is disenchantment. It is not, there's no joy, you know, whatever that definition was, you know, displeasure, disappointment, sadness, unhappy. It's not that. That's ordinary English. What disenchantment is a better way to think of it as disentanglement. You're disentangled with trying to make things a certain way. And instead, you are experiencing the joy of this moment. You are experiencing the ease and the peace of just being with the moment as it is. I think that Samvega and Posada, the part of that is you are ultimately, you put your faith and confidence, your clarity in the path. And you let the path be the guide to tell you how to respond in life. This Samvega and Posada to me are the antidote to what I call a false or a fake fear. We live in a really fake fear. What I mean by a fake fear is, I rarely leave my house. I go to the store and I come home. I don't really hang out with people anymore. I don't really do a lot of, you know, I don't go out. I used to go to all these restaurants. I don't go anywhere like that. And basically just to keep everybody safe and try to help the virus get dealt with. Not because I'm unhappy or isolated. We're just staying in the house, trying to keep the virus at bay. But I get terrified of catching this virus. Just the thought of it for a long time, especially when I came back in March, I was scared of the virus so badly. It took a while for me to actually get myself to realize that if I take precautions and do what I can, then that is the best I can do to ensure my safety. And whether I catch this virus or not has nothing to do with me. But even with my precautions, I didn't even notice that. I treated my fear of catching this virus was as if I was walking around, being around people, touching people, coughing, sneezing, around sick people. It's as if I was doing the very thing that would expose me to it. And I'm not really looking at reality. So in some respects, what I'm pointing to is we live in a fear of doomsday. A fear of everything going wrong, of this fear, and that fear of uncertainty. I don't know what's going to happen. Everything's going to be terrible. That fear creates so much depression, anxiety, worry. It just stacks on top of each other. But even in the best of times, we don't know what's going to happen. Even if the money was flowing good and my family's doing good and I'm doing good and there's no virus and sun is out, winter, whichever your season is that you like, the weather's perfect. Even then, you could step outside and get hit by a car. Just like that. Change your whole life. We've always lived with uncertainty. But because we have this false sense of control because of our entanglement in everything, we forget that we are not in control of anything. We never have been. Samvega Posada allows us to put our faith, our sense of trust in the path to help us know the best way to go. I tried to get rid of anxiety. I think you guys know this about me. I had so much anxiety for like 3 years. 2 years of it, I spent fighting this anxiety, trying to get rid of it, asking every teacher I could think of how to get rid of this anxiety. And then finally, I got rid of it. I shouldn't say I got rid of it. Finally, it lost its luster. I just resolved that, okay, I guess I'm just going to be with anxiety when I sit. So I'm okay. It's just the way it's going to be. I'm not fighting it anymore. And somehow, it took me 2 years to understand this, but 2 years of fighting turned into a surrendering. It took about 6 months for that anxiety to just work its way out. Because once we give up the entanglement, now we can begin to practice with whatever it is that's difficult. And the actual practice is designed to support us in suffering. So the sooner we turn towards suffering, the sooner the practice kicks in and the more sooner we find liberation. But as long as we're tussling and fighting with the suffering, we just stay more and more and more entangled in it. The felt sense of samvega and pasada, this felt sense of disenchantment. The best way I can explain it, it's a surrender, is what it is. But the best way I can explain it is, it's like when you're working out, if you work out and you reach this wall that says your muscles just like, I cannot lift anything else. I cannot run anymore. I'm done. It your body just says, I'm done. And that felt sense of just muscle fatigue is what it's called. It's sort of what it feels like with samvega. It feels like you come to this place of surrender. But for the egos that we have, that moment of surrender feels like a failure. But if you can begin to see that when you start noticing with this kindness, the limitations of your ability, if you see that as a knowing, this kind of might there be another way moment, then you can find a place of liberation. But if you see that moment as failure, then we get stuck in the failure and begin to spin around. I'll never be able to do this. It's not gonna work. This isn't, I don't know. This is all I'm gonna get. It's just a little bit of ease every once in a while. But if you see that moment when you come up on the reality that I'm overwhelmed, I'm sad, what kind of practice is this? It's not really supporting me. If you see that moment as might there be another way, then you can move into samvega, you can move into the pasada. Because once you say, might there be another way, you are actually opening the door for the pasada to come in and show you that there is another way. But if we come to that moment when it feels like our practice isn't working, it feels like I'm still overwhelmed, I'm too emotional, something's amiss here, it's not working. If we come to that moment and we think, oh, I'm a failure in practice, then we turn right back into that suffering and go at it again. So a mantra that I used to use for myself all the time after I saw that anxiety really didn't have to stay, is I would ask myself, what are you afraid of? What are you so afraid of? What's different about this moment than 20 minutes ago? All of a sudden, I've got this anxiety. What's so different? What's so scary or unsafe here? It's just these rhetorical questions. I'm not asking myself to answer it, but I'm asking myself to get myself to begin to notice there's a fear here. It's fake. It's not real. Is there really any danger here? Am I really not safe? I haven't left the house. What am I afraid of? I watched the news and now I'm scared. I haven't even left yet and I'm scared that COVID's coming in. If it wasn't in here yesterday and nobody's been in here but me, I don't think there's going to be any COVID coming in on its own unless those little germs got some good feet walking in there. I haven't even opened the front door and I'm scared. It's like, it was beginning to actually challenge this fear as to whether or not this fear is really real. Or is this the fake fear that I am beginning to realize I don't have any control? And I don't have any control. I can take precautions, but I don't have control. And coming to that understanding actually is more liberating. So I better stop here, or I could go on and on and on forever. Give us some time. We'll need some time to go walking, though. Contemplate what it is. Contemplating what you hear is very important. Not from the analyzing mind, but from the down in the body. What does this mean in my life? What is this pointing to? Where am I holding on to some fake fear? Where do I need to come to a place of disenchantment with? Disentanglement with? Where do I need to get out of the passion around it has to be a certain way? It doesn't mean you have to give up your political views or what you think should be going on or what you like or don't like. What it means is you give up this, I'm right about my political views. And instead, you hold it as, oh, this is just a view, just like everybody else has a view, and this is mine. Oh, do I? Ah, I do. Thank you so much, Metta. He reminded me I gave myself till 3:30 because I wanted to talk about Hiri and Otapa. Oh, I forgot. Good, 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 good. So once we get to this moment where we are willing to go a different direction, we don't have a clue how to go that different direction. We know that we don't want to go that way, but we have no idea how to go this way. We don't even know what this way is, what it looks like, how it looks, what is it gonna look like. When I got this book with the Trumpa, I used to read it. This was my practice. 45 minutes sitting quietly in what I called meditation, but really it was just going to my happy place, sitting quietly. I didn't have any instructions. I had instructions. Ben and Jerry put out a 3-minute meditation booklet, and I had that. So I would do what they said in the little 3-minute meditation. I just do it over and over and over and over and over, 45 minutes. This is my happy place. And I would read a slogan. And then all day, I would do it in the morning, and all day, I would try to see, what does this mean? What could this mean in my life? And every once in a while, I could bump up against what the slogan said and the way I was living. And this kind of, I don't know if I even agree with that. And I begin to see how to live based on these two pillars that you could think of on the side, kind of keeping me in the straight and narrow, because I know where the barriers are. That's what I think Hiri and Otapa is. I think it is our innate capacity for courage. And I call it courage, not the courage that we think of as I'm fierce, I'll run into a burning house and I'll save everybody. It's not that kind of courage. When I'm talking about courage is, I'm talking about an inner strength. There's an inner strength and capacity that allows us to move forward in our practice, even when we don't know where it's going. There's a confidence that comes within this courage. It's an alignment with our values, and it becomes, Hiri and Otapa become the compass by which we know how to move in the world. But I gotta tell you, this compass of Hiri and Otapa, this is another one of those emotional energies that's actually connected to a sense of ouch. Oh, it's that kind of feeling. Just like Samvega is futility of existence, Hiri is moral shame, is what it's translated to be. It's hard to see this moral shame as being anything other than the shame that we think of in English, where somebody puts you down, somebody squashes your esteem, your sense of self, and dismisses you. And that kind of dismissiveness feels like shame to us. But this Hiri and Otapa is actually what I would consider the antidote to that kind of shame, that selfishness or that low self-esteem, that spinning around in our self-centeredness. Hiri and Otapa is the opposite of that. I think it unhooks us from what I consider a fake shame. That shame that mentally oppresses us, that shame is not real shame. It is just mental criticism, judgment, aversion, hatred that just squishes us down more and more and more. But what a good, healthy dose of moral shame is in the Dhamma, it is a guidepost that helps us know when we're harming. It helps us know harm. This is what this shame is. It's the knowing of harm. It's the knowing of how important goodwill is in the world. And it's the knowing of how interconnected we are with each other, so that we do not want to cause anyone any harm. Not just theoretically, but because I'm so willing to feel suffering that I will know when I cause harm. There was a moment when I said something. I was on a retreat and I said something There was a white woman and a person of color with darker skin, and this white woman's skin was kind of an olive color, and in the sun, I just thought that was so beautiful. And so I mentioned to her, I love your skin tone. But I didn't even think about the person of color, and the person of color got upset. There was an awkwardness in that moment. I felt it. I thought the words came out. I was not trying to harm anyone, but I could feel something didn't land right. But we were about to go into the hall. Nobody said anything. So I just dismissed it. It's like, oh, it's okay. It didn't really feel right, but it's okay. And then towards the end, I was teaching a retreat, and these were two other people that were teaching the retreat with me. So at the end, the person of color came and wanted to have a talk with me. And I thought we were going to catch up on old times. We hadn't seen each other for a while. But actually, they wanted to tell me that I had offended them when I said that the white woman's skin color was so pretty, so beautiful. And at first, my whole reaction was, you're making a big deal out of nothing. That's a little bit much. You might want to check that. And I was doing a lot of pushback on it. But at some point, I have the sensitivity now because I've practiced with suffering and harm so much. I had this sensitivity. I could feel there was some pain here. And I remembered that even when I said it, it didn't land right. So I felt to myself, wait a minute, if I feel suffering, I don't know if it's my suffering or if it's their suffering, but there's some suffering here. And I need to make amends even for that. So there was a sense of learning to feel harm as a guide to help me know how to be in the world. It's strange, this idea of using harm as a guidepost, but harm on one side, when I feel it, and then harm on the other side is when I kind of, it's the empathy that you feel when I know my conduct is wrong. Or a better way to say it is, I would never want anyone to see my conduct and then say, there's something wrong with Buddhism. Because I know this Buddhist and she's like crazy. She don't even act like she's, yeah. I don't want to give the impression that Buddhist teachings are in any way harmful or wrong, or do any wrongdoing that people would connect to Buddhist teachings. That's the otapa side, the wrongdoing, not wanting to do wrong. So one is getting a sense that there's harm, whether it's the harm you committed or the harm you feel someone else has committed, but you can feel the harm. And when you feel the harm, compassion says we should do something. And the other side is wrongdoing. I might do something wrong. You know, in hearing in Otapa, the way it's described is like a pole. And on one side, you have excrement. And on the other side, you have a fire, a red hot, like it's red hot, been stuck in the fire. So if you touch the excrement side, you would go, eh! That's the felt sense of shame. That, ah, oh, I can't believe, oh, I can't believe I did that. Or I can't believe that happened. Mostly it's our own conduct. So it's mostly, I can't believe I did this. And the other side is hot, so hot that you don't want to touch it. You don't want to do it. I don't want this to happen in relation to me. One way that I began to kind of see into this is that I think Heri and Otapa is about light. It's about learning to see more clearly. When we walk into a room and we don't see anything, we bump into all this furniture. So we try to clear all the furniture away so we don't bump into it. But with Heri and Otapa, we're kind of shining the light on life. And yes, we're shining the light and we can see some of the pain, but their light shining is what helps us maneuver through the pathway and figure out how to maneuver through life without causing harm. I was at a retreat one time. I was teaching a retreat. I think this was last year. And at the end of my Dhamma talk, I shared this story. And I got a few little chuckles or whatever, and I left. But as I was walking, I was at Spirit Rock. And if you've ever been to Spirit Rock, there's a long walk that the teachers make from the dining hall all the way down to where the teachers' cottages are. And I'm walking down. I could have got a little ride in the cart, but I didn't want to because I needed to think. I didn't feel right about what I said. I didn't feel like I should have said that. Not that what I said was wrong, but it felt like I shouldn't have said it. Like I said too much about me and it wasn't about me and I shouldn't have said it without a bigger explanation, but I said it at the end. And so I left it like a thud. And so all night I began to think on this, feel bad about it. Cause you know, I've said it now, how am I going to go back and pull it back? And I kept trying to, okay, let it go to her. It's all over. You're just making a big deal out of nothing, but it wouldn't go. So the next morning, with the other teachers were in the teacher lounge, and I mentioned to them, I think I shouldn't have said what I said at the end. And they were like, oh no, Tori, that Dhamma talk was really good. Just ignore that. That's nothing. That's just second guessing. Ignore that. But for some reason, this felt different. It felt different. It didn't feel like I was just punishing myself. It felt like I had done something that even I knew when I did it, it wasn't really right. It felt sort of like that moment in time when I said I liked that woman's skin. So Philip Moffat, he's my mentor. I love him to death. And Philip was the main teacher there. And so I mentioned to him at lunchtime, I wanted to go for a walk and tell him this thing. And I shared with him that I thought I shouldn't have said what I said at the end. And I wonder what he thought. And he goes, I don't think you should have said it either. I said, I felt like I was exposing myself too much and I didn't have enough time to clarify it. And he goes, that's what I thought. I said, well, I've been dying here, feeling the pain of this. So can we move this conversation towards how to let go of all this? And he goes, you can't. You can't let go of it. This is the point, that when you're teaching, the way you're going to learn how to be a teacher is you're going to have to rub up against these edges when you've gone too far this side, gone too far that side. And you got to feel the pain of that so you know where too far is on either side. That's what Heri and Otapa is. There's a way in which we have to learn the steadiness of the middle way by way of rubbing up against too far, or rubbing up against too far. And we think, oh, I'm just going to walk down this line. Just walk right here, not going to move. But that doesn't bring the fullness of the path in front of us. It gives us a little bit of a line, but we don't see anything. In order for us to get a full path, We got to open to the whole thing. So here's how I think all of this kind of relates together on our path. We have, I'm assuming, chosen this eightfold path as a way that we're going to walk through the world. And here's how these three sets of emotions actually bring us into this path. So you can think of metta as the ethical conduct. So eightfold path, three trainings: wisdom, ethical conduct in the middle, and meditative qualities at the bottom. So metta is in the middle. It's the our ethical conduct, our conduct in the precepts, in speech, and in livelihood. We would move with this quality of metta that we connect to, whatever that word is. It's this non-harming, this quality of softening, kindness, letting it in, receptivity, whatever that word is that best helps you include this too. And that emotional energy, we wrap it around our conduct. And this would be on the near shore. The far shore, if we make our way around the river, come up on the far shore. We pound our stake in the near shore here once we get our conduct aligned with kindness. We go all the way around, drag the second pole to the other side of the shore, and we put a pole there. We get there. Takes a while, but we put a pole there. That's the wisdom side. And the wisdom side is Samvega, Pasada. It's this right view, right intention. This knowing that it is futile to try to live in a world where we're trying to control everything and that it's all about me. And instead, we put our faith in right intentions, these three intentions: to do no harm, to, you know, goodwill, be as kind as we can, and not in renunciation, to live a renounced life. So simpler, I don't have to get my way all the time. That's the far shore. The hardest poke that we got to put, we got one more stake we got to put in the ground, and then we can string this rope across, and then we can get across our little bridge and go across from one shore to the other without any difficulty. Ease. And that's the stake we got to put down in the middle of this raging river. That's the meditative qualities. Effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. That's Hiri and Otapa. That's the capacity to strengthen our attention to this present moment by using harm and the pain of that harm as a guide, by using the fear of wrongdoing and the shock of harm to be our guides that helps us, steady us. And with that, we can get that stake down in the middle. And now that we have the three stakes, we can then string a rope across and create our bridge. And then we can go across. The path actually helps us go across from one shore to the other with very little difficulty. I think I want to end with another poem. I like this poem. It's called Trough, Trough by Judy Sorum Brown. And they say, there is a trough in waves, a low spot where horizon disappears and only sky and water are our company. And there we lose our way. So there's a trough in waves, a low spot where horizon disappears and only sky and water are our company. And there we lose our way. It's this going down in the wave. There we lose our way. Unless we rest knowing the wave will bring us to its crest again. There we may drown if we let fear hold us within its grip and shake us side to side and leave us flailing, torn, disoriented. Right? You can see it. You go down. If you panic down, you could drown. But if you let the wave come right on back up and crest again, you will not. So if we rest there in the trough, are silent, being with the low part of the wave, keeping our energy and noticing the shape of things, the flow, then time alone will bring us to another place where we can see the horizon, see the land again, regain our sense of where we are and where we need to swim. So time alone will bring us to another place where we can see horizon, see the land again, regain our sense of where we are and where we need to swim. This is what Samvega, Basada, Hiri, Otapa, and Metta, that's what it does for us. They are the qualities that the emotional experience, the capacity that when we are in the trough and we are down in the low of the waves, they are what bring us back up into and show us the horizon again so we know where to swim. What harms us the most is when we get into these low parts and these places where it seems like our understanding, our practice, our wisdom is not working. Something's amiss. When we get there, we start flailing about. And that flailing about, trying to set things in motion, get it under control, get it back the way it's supposed to be, that is what causes suffering. All right. So, time for some walking.